Welcome to the Karma School of Business, a podcast about the private equity industry, business best practices, and real-time trends. In this episode, we have a wonderful conversation with my friend Andy Greenberg, CEO of Greenberg Variations Capital. This episode is brought to you today by Blue Wave. I'm Sean Mooney, Blue Wave's founder and CEO. Blue Wave is the go-to expert of those with expertise. Blue Wave connects proactive business builders, including more than 500 of the world's leading private equity firms and thousands of leading companies, to the very best professional service providers for their critical, variable, on-point, and on-time business needs. Enjoy. I am very excited to be here with my friend Andy Greenberg, who's CEO of Greenberg Variations Capital. Andy, great to be here with you today.
Great to be here with you, Sean. Looking forward to it.
Yeah. So as listeners might surmise, Andy and I have known each other a little bit. So if we get a little casual, forgive us in advance. But we're going to have a great conversation here. We're going to talk a little bit about Andy's background. We're going to talk about most of the time about how the face of the M&A markets have changed quite a bit over time. And then we'll talk about some other fun stuff. So maybe to jump right in, Andy, I would love to get a little bit more on your origin story. Can you tell us a little bit, kind of your life story, how you came up in the world, finance, entrepreneurship, where you are today, all those type of things?
Sure. As you know, my career took an early kind of crazy detour. I grew up here in suburban Philadelphia, where I live and have spent most of my career. I went to college at Brown, law school at Harvard, and was always a pretty business-minded law student, interested in venture capital and finance. But I was like a year into law practice with the firm that is now Faegre Drinker. And through a fluky series of events, I got involved in a political campaign. A guy named Bob Casey Sr. was running for governor of Pennsylvania. He got elected. And at age 26, I was part of a small coterie of young people around the governor. So, you know, I went from, you know, being beaten on to check on post-effective statements with the SEC to working in Harrisburg. And I worked in what was then the Department of Commerce. It's now called Community and Economic Development. And after a few years at age 30, I became the secretary of the department. So I had an early heady experience in politics and government.
Wow. So Secretary of Commerce at the age of 30. And that is something that I never knew about you before we did this podcast here. So tell me, what was it? What do you even do as Secretary of Commerce of a state?
Two things. First, manage a series of grant and loan programs that fund business development and infrastructure. And encourage businesses to locate or expand in the state. And that world has changed over the past 25, 30 years, just as government spending has shifted and interest rates have come down. But going back to the 80s and 90s, that was really the heyday of state industrial development. The other responsibility was acting as spokesperson for the business community on economic issues. And there I picked up a discipline that I think has been helpful as an investment banker. Bob Casey Sr., a wonderful guy, a true New Deal Democrat. So on every issue of interest to business, labor issues, government regulation, taxes, he could pretty reliably be expected to line up on the side opposite the business community. So as a young guy, I had to learn how to maintain my credibility with that constituency without giving up the guy in the big office. And a lot of, you know, you can just kind of relate to it, to the balance that we all need to have as deal professionals.
Yeah, you're playing, I'm sure, multidimensional chess. And, you know, with pretty high stakes and a lot of probably sophisticated people who had been in that game for a long time. And when I think back when I was 30, I don't think I was barely trusted to even anecdotally negotiate a term sheet. So in your well, work.
Well, yeah, for sure. And, you know, in 1995, I left. And, you know, as I said to you before we were taping, I think, well, you know, we all have decisions in our careers that we value and ones we regret. One of the best decisions I made was getting out of government then. I mean, I sold that stock at the 5-year high. You know, I did not want to continue. I had an opportunity to get into investment banking with Brown Brothers Harriman. I was based in Philadelphia, but I spent a lot of time with the people in New York. And, you know, you said you didn't know about the political background. I think it's only in recent years that I've started talking about it more, because early on, it was such a jarring disconnect. You know, I mean, I was a mid-level banker learning how to do DCF analysis from younger colleagues. So having had this experience in government, it was like I was a child actor who had been in a successful TV show, and now I was expected to be in a Broadway play, and I never had acting lessons. So it wasn't really helpful to talk to people about the whole political thing, you know, until I backfilled and, you know, developed some skills in finance.
And Andy, maybe, and not to age you and not to age me, but what point in time was this? So you're going from politics into investment banking around what time?
Mid-90s. 1995.
Okay. So we're very much in that same kind of vintage of like entering into investment banking. And I think that's a really good kind of segue as we talk about kind of this changing face of M&A. What did M&A look like in the mid-90s, you know, and thereabouts?
Well, this will be the part of the program where you and I get to establish ourselves as true old farts. But you know, from the perspective, yeah, I'm a little older than you, but for, you know, from the perspective of people who are getting into the field now or in the past 10 years, it was much more pick and shovel work. You know, the market was less efficient. You know, from the perspective of bankers, people kind of had their relationships. There were not processes where hundreds of books were being sent out, in part because we didn't send stuff electronically, right? Yeah. We did it by FedEx, and clients didn't want to pay for analysts to print and mail out 300 books. So everything took longer. The world is making the transition from Lotus 1-2-3. You know, you and I are just too young to remember VisiCalc. We're not that old, right? Yeah. But Excel was just getting the upper hand over Lotus. And as you and I have discussed, everything was labor. You know, assembling a peer group was not something done effortlessly and quickly. You had to put in parameters and wait for a download. If you were getting together information on publicly traded comps, again, no download. Depending on where you worked, you were sweet talking the librarian to get Edgar filings for you, and then you had to go through them. So people in our age bracket like to think that there was a lot of learning in going through those steps, but there's no doubt that it just took more effort than the same tasks do now.
Oh, 100%. I think the reason why I was one of the more kind of sought after financial analysts in kind of the mid to late 90s was because I was really good at binding books. And so like it, to paint a picture for people, we had, you know, you had printers in your offices and you would print them up. And then we all had mail rooms where there were people who were there ostensibly to kind of bind these books together that would then go into FedEx. But inevitably you wouldn't get your comments until midnight. And then you'd have to redo all the books because then the graphic artists were gone. And then at 3 a.m. you would start printing these things. And then at 5 a.m. you would start binding them. If you couldn't, you know, if the meeting was in New York that next day. And so I was really good at binding books. And so I think I was sought after not because of anything I do about wattage or analytical skills, et cetera. It's just I got fewer paper cuts than others and I could like print well. And so, but that was the 90s, you know.
And you were working in downtown in Manhattan.
Yeah, we were in Midtown. So I was in Houlihan Lokey's financial restructuring group. And so luckily a lot of our meetings were in New York, which meant that I could work all night, every night, because we didn't have to get it.
So you probably had a hierarchy of FedEx pickup times where you do it like you're building the box on the corner.
100%. And you take a car service to the later one. And if that didn't work, we had a service that would pick up a plane that was on call to actually pick up the decks at any time. And then there would be like a $5,000 delivery fee to fly it somewhere. So it was like the good old times. And like everyone, I think as we, I don't know about you, but as we think about these times, everyone thinks it was so much easier back then. It wasn't, just because there's so much more asymmetry in efficiency and information gathering, et cetera. So it's still really hard because it was just so much harder to do things. You know, versus today, the world's your oyster, everything's in your hands.
Well, we also had to think through more things rather than relying on some algorithm to determine whether a peer was a peer. You had to go through those filings and look at a public company and see what percentage of revenues in the business group were associated with the business you were working with, and you make a judgment call. And you're a younger person, you talked about it with the VP who was on the job. And you know, as I said before, it was more pick and shovel work. And you know, I am not one to say that I think people in the past were sharper than people today. I think we get to work with a lot of plenty sharp young people. But they get their sharpness from different experiences because they're not called on to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's you know, things are always just different, but they're not necessarily easier in one time or another. And whether you're talking about the NBA or investment banking or private equity, there's different times and things evolve. And I think you're totally right. I think today it's still very much an apprenticeship business, but just in different ways, and you're able to maybe jump through some of the picks and shovels a little bit more. And it's more about the, you know, in some ways how things kind of you can jump past that first step a bit. And so maybe that's a good segue, Andy. You've been in the business, you've seen it evolve. How has the business evolved today versus maybe those kind of grand old times, you know, when we were starting off? What does it look like today versus then?
I think it has evolved significantly, even over the past decade. And, you know, Blue Wave has perfectly encapsulated some of the trends that I'm about to talk about. You know, since leaving Brown Brothers, I've spent most of the past 15, 20 years with middle market investment banks, again, based here, more generalist in nature, but primarily focused in working with industrial businesses. 10 years ago, I think the coin of the realm was relationships and distribution. And firms, investment banking firms, got mandates by being able to impress clients with industry knowledge as a means to an end. And the end was relationships with strategic and financial buyers and an affinity where, you know, the person who was a step removed would be talking, you know, in the pitch, would be talking about multiples and macro trends. And the specialist would be able to say, oh, is you know, Charlie, you know, is he back from his skiing injury? Yeah, I mean, they're getting to be acquisitive again. And, you know, clients can judge three things. They can judge whether they like you. They can judge whether they think you're smart, and they can judge whether you know their world. And that really emerged. And, you know, the industry boutiques and, you know, the larger, higher volume middle market deal shops, you know, their coin of the realm was just having more distribution based on that. Being able to get out, you know, more books quickly into the hands of informed buyers. I started Greenberg Variations Capital in 2019 because I saw that movement toward industry specialization. I wanted to continue to work with businesses across a somewhat broader range of sectors in the industrial field. So I saw the subset of business owners who, for good reason, were not headed for a far-flung auction. It was one, two, five, or six buyers. And I don't really like one buyer, you know, two to six optimal. So they didn't need and didn't want to pay for the staffing, the infrastructure, and all of the stuff of the auction. So GVC basically uncoupled marketing from execution, and we just provide execution. So that's my path to a more structured approach. And then, of course, I mean, you don't need me to tell the Blue Wave story.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've kind of watched you build a business also based on private equity firms and the deal ecosystem seeking a more and more refined view of a given business.
I think you brought up a number of, I think, really, really good examples of what's happened. And I thought you very elegantly summed up what happened a lot of the market. So as I turn the, you know, my lens backwards, you know, in the late 90s, early 2000s, you know, it's almost the pendulum has kind of gone fully back. In the late 90s, there was information asymmetry. And so there were trusted advisors who had access to information and network that no one else had. The world was a smaller place. And then tons and tons of private equity firms and investment bankers came in. And then the world became more and more efficient. And the name of the game in kind of like the 2000s to maybe the mid-2015s-ish was large numbers and efficiency. So the investment bankers would do a 200 PE firm auction with another 50 you know, strategics involved. And it was just brute force, boil the ocean, and that would drive an outcome. But then what happened, you know, in my mind since that point was then you entered this era of, you know, there's so much efficiency. They entered a new age of enlightenment, both on the investment banker and the private equity side, where specialization became important, where it all became about alpha, not beta, because beta used to get you results. And the returns were good enough for investment banker for private equity firms, and the money was good enough for investment bankers. And I think what you really, really appropriately pointed out is we're in this new era, and now it's about specialization, and it's about being better at fewer things and really driving insights to drive outcomes. And that's true. You know, we certainly saw it in the private equity side, and that's really why I founded Blue Wave. Is I needed alpha, I needed specialization, I needed the right resource for exactly what I needed when I need it. And I think and the same thing you're articulating in the investment banking world, it's about knowing what's going to happen before they do it and not brute forcing it, because that gives you beta. And what you're doing at Greenberg Variations Capital is bringing alpha. And so I'd love to maybe drill down on that a little bit.
Well, it goes to your comment about information asymmetry. There are certainly still industry sectors and deals where it makes sense to have a wide open process with the idea of capturing an outlying bid. But, you know, I talk to friends, I'm sure you do too, and, you know, the most active middle market investment banks, and they don't talk about the auction in as many processes as they used to. And there is more information on the business owner side. And it's very easy to caricature the owner operator as like the classic data miner and, you know, the guy who remembers the one deal that was done at 11 times in his industry and beats you over the head with that. But information is information. And somebody who builds a successful business is usually pretty shrewd, even if they are pushing investment bankers to be more aspirational. So I do think that there are more processes where, you know, to your point about alpha, there are more processes where market clearing value is going to be within a relatively narrow range. And what the market wants on both sides is efficiency, certainty of close, and quick, thorough ventilation of the issues that could cause a deal to go sideways. And that's where my approach comes in. And that's where, you know, the appetite comes in for a sponsor calling you and not necessarily looking for a general broad industry view, but say, hey, we're buying this type of business and we need somebody who can talk to us about how, you know, production lines are assembled in this industry. And there's an answer for that.
100%. And that's exactly the questions we get. It's like we have a company that is a food manufacturing company that has high mix, low volume manufacturing for the organic food snack business, and the company's in the Midwest. And we need someone to both assess it, but then also live in the plant for 6 months. And it used to be, you know, 15, 10, even 5 years ago, even shorter than that, it used to be, I need a Lean Six Sigma person. Because you need to get every little element right. And where it used to be times right now, we've got the deal market is in effect right now. And it could be, I need a commercial due diligence provider. And it used to be, I'm going to go to the large firm that everyone knows that does commercial due diligences. And on that same vein, they're like, no, I need the commercial due diligence group that knows the high mix, low volume, multi-tier distribution, food snack manufacturer in the Midwest who already knows that world. And so I think that you're right in that that's where the world maybe is and is going. And to your point, the information can be available not only for the private equity firms, but the same vein, the investment bankers are continually evolving in their own right. And so maybe let's talk a little bit about that in terms of how did that lead you to, with that in mind, to bring Greenberg Variations Capital to be?
What I saw in my investment banking practice, and also we haven't talked about GF Data, but you know, in the data company that Graham Frazier and I started in 2005, was that industry expertise, as it was practiced and marketed by investment banks, generally had to do with buyer identification, qualification, and relationships. It didn't have to do with building and articulating the value proposition. So I would say to someone today that, you know, if you have a business in, you know, one of these high multiple commercial services, you know, HVAC, services being provided to HOAs where you don't really know how high is high, go and hire an investment bank that's going to market the hell out of the property, because they're the center of gravity is with the marketing. But there are other businesses, as I said before, where valuation can be higher or lower within a trading range, but the center of gravity in the assignment is understanding where you need to take the clients to cement a value proposition that will carry through to closing. So in the past year, we've done a couple of deals in medical devices. Extremely profitable, highly valued businesses. I am not a boutique authority in the medical device industry, but I understand looking at, you know, strategic buyers owned by private equity groups on the other side, that the value proposition there is helping them understand with incredible particularity in each case how an extremely profitable business makes its money. What are production cycles? What is the usage of material? How is labor dealt with in a business where there's almost no direct labor involved? And whether it's the company's management team or retaining the kind of outside experts that you're involved with, you know, I saw an ability to get involved with business owners away from the wide open auction and say, look, there are five, six, eight likely buyers for this business. They're all knowledgeable. None of them needs us to educate them on the market and the opportunity. But let's talk about the questions that they will ask in order to get to closing at the kind of elevated multiple. You know, in that industry, double digit to teens multiple. And let's figure out how to make that happen.
So I really like the way that you said that and the way that you were thinking that led you to this business here. And in part, going back to what you said earlier, it's like there is certainly a time and place for the big firm, big process, or different type of methodology that they're going to be taken from the kind of the larger shops. But there's absolutely another place in that market to have this curated experience where you know who the buyers are and you don't need to necessarily do the big machine. And it resonates a lot with me from my investing days, where those were the types of almost companies that we had looked for. It's like, we're not going to try to own a market or be everything to everyone. We're going to try to be good at one part of the market and be really good at that. And we were very successful doing that. And you've taken that same approach to investment banking advisory. And I think that's got to resonate really well. In the same vein with your approach, you're not turning companies upside down. And because when we would go through the big machine, and I think that's evolving in many places, but when we would do it, your company was just exhausted by the time you got through it.
Right, right. It requires a very cold-eyed, realistic view of every situation because there are a lot of scenarios that get presented as a targeted process, and they shouldn't be really.
Yeah.
You know, owner of a business got a call from a business development person or a buy-side search firm, and they happened to get him in the office, and now he feels like, well, what does this mean? Well, it could be that there are three or four dozen private equity groups that would be interested in that business as a platform. And it's not a good use of my time to try to suggest anything else to them. But it works the other way. We get referred into situations by attorneys, wealth managers, and other trusted advisors. And it often is helpful for the clients to have come from discussions with more traditional M&A firms, where part of the pitch was being talked into something that they didn't really want to do, right? There was a theory of why it made sense to be interested in a handful of buyers. And, you know, for traditional investment bank, it's not really economical to do that. Like the way we're set up, if you're doing little marketing and focusing on execution, you could charge less. So we price at a discount to what a traditional M&A firm would charge for the fully loaded sales mandate. You know, if they work with us on a one-off and it becomes something else and they don't want to continue, then I don't want to make their life contractually complicated. So they like the fact that we just focus on the thing.
I love that approach. And it's in some ways, it's kind of treat the business of your business like a business and have the audacity to ask your customers what they want and they'll tell you. And you're providing a solution that's needed and wanted in the market to people going through one of the most important decisions of their life. And so I think that's got to come off really well with them when you're able to put it all out there, listen to what they want and respond. And for that, they give you all the trust in the world with their most important asset, probably of their life, other than their friends, family, and children.
Exactly right.
Or at least family and children. At least family and children.
It's some of their kids.
At least right. One of their kids. So, you know, I think that's a good thing to kind of transition here on, in that we've talked about where the market has come from, where it is today, with this really unique vantage that you have. Where do you see it going in the visible future?
Setting Sean Mooney aside for the time being, for me, the most memorable guest that Charlie Gifford and I have had on our podcast, Middle Market Musings, was Eugene Fama. the Nobel Prize winning economist at the University of Chicago and the father of efficient market theory. And I think in many ways we're living out the prophecy of Fama and his colleagues that the market is becoming more and more and more efficient. And artificial intelligence has become a big part of the discussion. And I think you and I agree that there's both steak and sizzle there.
Absolutely.
But I think that directionally, the process of selling businesses will continue to evolve in the direction of applying expertise to prospective buyers, the company, and the value proposition, as opposed to the brute force of the marketing exercise.
I 100% agree that there's going to efficiency is the constant in this industry, in any industry, really. And if you think, most people don't realize that the capital markets world is an industry, right? And it started off in the 80s and 90s, and maybe early 2000s, and it was relatively inefficient. More information came to bear. This thing called the internet came to bear. This thing called the iPhone came to bear. You introduced this great tool called GF Data that gave everyone insights into key capital market metrics that help make them make their decisions better. So all of this is playing out into this world that has been gradually maturing, as every industry does. And it seems to me, you know, what's happening and what will happen will, you know, follow some other markets and see how they've evolved. They become more sophisticated. You know, with the advent of AI, this is going to be the greatest efficiency enhancer in my mind since the advent of the modern internet in 1995 with Netscape. And so I 100% agree that the world is going to be playing this game, and it's going to be like anything else, harder and harder to find alpha, but it's still going to be really good compared to most other things. Mm-hmm. So it's in my mind, it's not a message like, woe is me. It's just, okay, don't hate the player, hate the game. We're all going to have to work a little harder.
And there will still be a role on the buy side for smaller sponsors who have the focus and the tenacity to achieve beta.
Absolutely. And I think the world is, it in some ways, I think there's going to be, in the private equity world, there'll certainly be consolidation at the top of the market. There's going to be more fragmentation at the bottom of the market, like you see, because the big PE firms anyways won't be able to do the smaller end of the market efficiently, because they're going to be built to handle the large checks. And the same way, you're going to see that exactly mirrored in the advisory market. The big will probably continue to get bigger, and there are going to be the boutiques that address the lower end of the market that in some ways is the most interesting, highest returning end of the market, but it's just harder to do at scale. How does that resonate with you?
It's classic Porter theory that you can't be great at two things at once. So on the sponsor side, it's very hard to excel at gathering assets in volume and at achieving consistent above par returns. You got to pick one. And then on the advisory side, I think it's the same idea, that you can focus on scale, or you can focus, as I have, on a kind of specialization. But Porter's language, you don't want to get middled. and yeah. I think in both ends of the industry, you know, the consolidation occurs among firms that are not really disposed to be great at one of the relevant strategies.
Yeah, I think that is spot on, and you pointedly portrayed where this world's going if we just look at some of the models that we've all seen to become true in the history. And the one thing that I would say is, you think about the people in this industry, they're incredibly tenacious, they're smart enough, they're clever, and they're going to find a way to continue to be successful in what is otherwise a very large set of markets, even as they kind of tectonically move away from each other and distinctively form continents, maybe. And one of the things that, you know, what I would say is I reflect even on these prior changes, and it's been a pretty consistent and, you know, movement over time, is that every year I would say, oh, I wish I was 10 years old. And then 10 years later, I go, oh, I wish I was 10 years older. And 10 years later, well, okay, I'll stop with the 10s. And then, but it was, but they were all still good times. It was just relative to maybe a more distant past, it seems like it wasn't as good. And I think when people and I look at 10 years from now, it's going to be like, oh, I wish I was 10 years older, but it's still going to be pretty darn good. So maybe as a good turning point here, let's talk about a little bit more about the lighter topics. And one of the things that, you know, I think we all do when we're after a long day and friends like you and I and Charlie, we're at a bar afterwards or something and drinking, you know, being responsible is that we will wax poetic about, you know, some of the look in the rear view mirror and the things we knew now that we wish we knew then. And if we only had a time machine. So I'd be really curious, Andy, maybe what's one of these things that you'd go back to young Andy and say, hey, kid, listen up.
Periodically on the podcast, I talk about its number one unwilling listener, my 16-year-old son, who gets it like on the way to school, on the way home from wrestling practice, and has no shortage of critical comments. So I told him I was doing this podcast. He says, Charlie going to be there? And I said, no, just me. And he said, who's going to listen to that?
Sounds like my kids.
Your
kid.
So the only line in the New Testament that I quote is, no man is a prophet in his homeland.
Yeah. Amen.
I got a lot of opportunities to use that. So what advice would I give younger Andy? I think just say yes. You know, as things cross your field of vision, have a disposition to try different things. And, you know, I guess the modern fashionable way to say that might be lean in, but of course, I mean is more fundamental than that. I did more sports when I was in junior high school. When I got into high school, I was small. I gravitated to brainy activities like debate. And the guy who is the lacrosse coach at my high school came up to me after, he was a history teacher. He came up to me after class one day and he said, you know, the varsity eight is looking for a coxswain. And I just looked down my nose at it. And, you know, I thought coxswain was like glorified equipment manager on the rowing team. That's an example of something I really regret as I've gotten older. I don't know that it would have been a life-changing event, but of course, as you know, you learn about that sport and what that means. That would have been a terrific challenge for me. And, you know, that's an educator, right? I mean, that's an example of a teacher looking at a kid and thinking he does okay, you know, in class, but this would be a good thing for him. And I didn't say yes. And I think, you know, we all get into those situations. We recognize them more readily as we get older. But, you know, my advice for younger people would be, where possible, try to say yes.
And what would be an example of one of those times where you were going to say no and you said yes?
That's an interesting question. Where I got into something that was totally outside of my comfort zone. I have never felt as prosperous as when I was a first-year law firm associate making $37,000 a year. And leaving that job to work for a long-shot political campaign was, that took a deep breath, and I did it with a buddy of mine, and I told myself that the chances that it would be such a failure that I ended up at Skid Row were small, and did it.
I think that's an amazing example. And then you were the Secretary of Commerce of a founding state at age 30. That's amazing.
Well, yeah, right. It paid off. But as I said, it also had a quality of having a kind of heady success early where I needed to go back and pay some dues later. But it worked out.
But that's interesting because, like, you know, it speaks to kind of the way I think of the world is like life is not a straight road up and to the right. It's more of a meandering path. But, you know, the most straight road to Rome isn't always the fastest or best. And so, you know, the example maybe I would use on maybe a wrong turn, but eventually right turn was I grew up in Texas and I decided, you know, as it was a small school and every kid had to play football because we couldn't field a team. And so I go into this thing and our coach was a former All-American tight end for the University of Texas. And so I go into this thing and like you in eighth grade, I was 5 feet tall and I probably weighed 100 pounds. And my freshman year, I think I did something where I couldn't get into it. So sophomore year, I'm starting to grow a little bit and springing up and very awkward years. But the coach looks at me and my dad is 6'4". And my brother is 3 years younger than me, but it was at that point taller than me. And he goes, Sean, you're going to be tall like your dad. And so we're going to put you at tight end because that's my favorite position. And the only good player we had on our team was the all-state tight end who grew up on a ranch and chewed tobacco since he was age 4. And so immediately I go out there like, you got it, coach. I go out there. 3 concussions later, every day he's jamming my head into the dirt. I'm going down. I had a 1-year career in football. But on the flip side, I then started studying a lot harder. I joined the student council. I found my ways. I left my football career behind, but it led me to another road. So, but if I hadn't said then yes to that, I probably would have, you know, gone on a whole different path. So I love that example. And, you know, you think about, you know, the things that we do, they require a lot of time. It's a lot of effort. And one of the things that I'm always kind of thinking about as I've gained a little bit of perspective is like, how do I find little life hacks that are like, not only even just business, but just things that make my life a little easier. And so I'd be curious, do you have anything that you've kind of figured out recently or previously where you say, you know what, this thing makes a lot of sense. And boy, I'm really happy that I have this in my world because it just makes things just a little bit easier.
Part of my classic dad profile is that I think of myself as a very good griller. So I could give you a recipe, but everyone has their way of making things. So what I will share is that when you are a young parent and you have a booster seat in your car, you will never get another device which is useful for holding a propane tank. So my youngest son is now 16. I still have a booster seat. And when I go to get the propane refills for the grill, it just pop it right in and it works great. So that's my life hack.
That is deceptively and quietly brilliant. I'm really angry at myself right now because why didn't I keep those car seats? You know, from when my kids were younger, because every car I've ever owned has that little like slash across the glove box where the propane tank kind of like juggles around as I'm driving and just carves up, you know, the front of my seat.
You make a turn and just that loud thunk.
Literally so every car.
My sons would say that is totally on brand for me. I can't watch a football game without them just rolling at any Progressive insurance commercial and saying, oh my God, like labeling the trash cans. That's the sort of thing that you do.
The Home Depot music. That's great. So I am going to actually, my youngest sister now has a newborn and she's going down that journey of having, you know, her children. And I'm going to remind her right after this call that she needs to save each one of those. And as she moves on to the next, you know, booster seat, as the kids progress to get older, I'm going to see how I can get her last one. so I think it's a great life hack.
Having kids that age and having, having to strap those booster seats in on an airplane, isn't that like the worst experience that you and your wife
have
had?
I do not miss that at all. Renting a car afterwards. Like, how do I get him in a car seat? And the, you know, if you ask me, I'm like, hey, the kids will be fine. My wife's like, you can't do that. So she's the wiser one. So don't think less of me, listeners.
Right.
So Andy, this has been a ton of fun. I really, really appreciate it. I've learned in an infinite amount here, and I have tons of notes from this. So thank you for joining us today and sharing your two cents.
Thank you. As always, great to talk with you, Sean.
Absolutely.
Special thanks to Andy for joining. If you'd like to learn more about Andy or Greenberg Variations Capital, please see the episode notes or links. Please continue to look for the Karma School of Business podcast anywhere you find your favorite podcasts, including Apple, Google, and Spotify. We truly appreciate your support. If you like what you hear, please follow, rate, review, and share. It really helps us when you do this, so thank you in advance. In the meantime, if you need to be connected with the world's best-in-class, private equity grade, professional service providers, independent consultants, interim executives, or anything else, give us a call or visit our website at bluewave.net. That's BLUWAVE, and we'll support your success. Onward.